Okay, it's 1:30, so let's call the meeting to order. And welcome to the PUD Commission meeting for September the 13th, 2021. We're virtual, of course. And so, again, welcome. Our first business item is, our first item is to approve the consent agenda.
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
I'll second that.
And moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for September the 13th, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, agenda revisions. Doug, do we have anything?
Yeah, we've got Sean's going to be filling up Jamie on Resolution 2212-21, establishing titles and monthly salary ranges for staff employees. And if you want me to, I guess during correspondence and communications, I can give the public that wasn't on a little while ago a little update on the COVID at the D.
Okay, good. All right. Our next item is comments from the public. Sean, you're going to handle this.
Yeah, if anybody has a comment they want to make, please let me know now, and I'll put your name on the list. Hearing none, Will, and there's also nothing in the chat.
Okay, we'll move on to business items. First item is Resolution 2210-21, authorizing defeasance of certain of the outstanding electric system revenue bonds. Now, a lot of people haven't heard defeasance. You want to explain that one, Sean? I think we're going to pay them off with funds, but go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. So in the last board meeting, I discussed with the commissioners that we plan to move forward with defeasing our 2014 revenue bonds, and then proceeding with a new bond issuance in about a month. So this defeasance piece here for the 2014 bonds is actually the first step in a multi-part process to realize the $1.8 million in net present value savings. So this resolution allows us to pay off the bonds from 2014 by putting district monies from the CETA decarbonization fund, a portion of our debt service reserve fund, and monies from the rate stabilization fund into an escrow account with U.S. Bank. And then at a future meeting, I'll bring another resolution to you that will authorize the district to issue new bonds in 2021 at a lower interest rate. And the resolution before you is actually prepared by Nancy Nearest, who is our attorney. And so that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's a two-part process, and the next resolution will come, I'm assuming, at the next meeting, but Nancy might not have it available until the second meeting in October.
The object is to save on interest rate, I guess.
Correct. Yes.
Can you share with us the interest rate for the 2014 bonds and what you expect for the new bonds?
The interest rate, I can defer to Ruth. Ruth, do you know exactly what the interest rate is on the 2014 bonds?
Give me just 1 second.
And then on the new bonds, Rick, they're estimating around 2%, but we won't know until we actually go to the market.
And put your John Henry on the line?
Exactly, yep. But they're very close and accurate on their estimates.
It's pretty amazing, though, when you can refinance a 2% bond to get a cheaper interest rate.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. The new bonds will be about 2%. The old bonds are higher.
Well, you know, this was the basis for the regional cooperation debt that Energy Northwest did with Bonneville, and that saved ratepayers something like $2 billion over the past few years. So,
and this would save us $1.8 million, right, Sean?
Yeah, a billion would sound better, but yeah,
let's make it a billion.
That'd be good.
I remember the old days when interest rates were double digit. It seems like a fairy tale at this point.
I know. People getting mortgage loans under 3%, it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, of course, CD rates are pretty damn low.
Yeah.
For an investor, it's not a good time for that type of thing.
Well, inflation is starting too.
Right.
So, how volatile are interest rates now? Does our experts say?
They fluctuate, daily, Will, but they're still extremely low. Everything that we've gone out to the market and looked for is all under 1% for savings. Most of them are actually less than 0.25%.
John, can you name a couple of the bonds that you likely will pursue, just to my edification?
So Piper Sandler is our underwriter. It used to be Piper Jaffray, and so what they do on the day of the bond issuance, they actually will send the bonds to market, and then anybody can go in and buy them. And typically, they're bought up by insurance companies. Extremely wealthy individuals have been known to buy our bonds. So it's really anybody's guess as to who's going to buy them, but it's quite an interesting process. Oh, to answer your question, Rick, Ruth said that the current ones are at 4.238%.
Wow, so more than cutting them in half.
Yeah.
Good job.
So with that, staff recommends adopting Resolution 2210-21, authorizing the defeasance of certain outstanding electric system revenue bonds from 2014.
I move that we accept did someone have a question?
No, sorry, Rick. Go ahead.
I move that we accept Resolution 2210-21, authorizing the defeasance of certain of the outstanding electric system revenue bonds, 2014.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 2210-21. Authorizing the defeasance of certain of the outstanding electric system revenue bonds from 2014. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you, Sean. Our next item is Resolution 2210-21, adopting the district's investment policy. Sean, you're very popular today. Go ahead.
Yep. So this is more of a housekeeping item. To update our existing investment policy. The current policy that we have in place was from 1996 and really includes some items that were no longer relevant, excuse me, or applicable. So Ruth has been working very diligently with our financial advisor, Peter Becker at TVI, as well as with the Washington Public Treasurers Association. And as you'll see in the agenda packet, I included a letter from the Washington Public Treasurers Association certifying our new policy. So we will actually be awarded a plaque at their next event, which I believe is at Lake Chelan next spring. And this update is part of a larger project that T has been tasked with from Doug, where he's asked all of us to update our policies and make sure that they're relevant and current. And so this is part of that broader assignment. So staff recommends the adoption of Resolution 2211-12, adopting the district's investment policy, and then rescinding our old policy and addendums, which is 1520-96, 2146-19, and 2190-21.
So is this updating already complete? I don't see any revisions in this.
Yeah, so what we did is we sent the policy off to the Washington Public Treasurers Association first. They certify it and give us the letter, and then now we're bringing it to you for adoption.
So they vetted it then?
They vetted the policy, correct.
And the honor that we're getting with that recognition next year is another quite good thing that the finance and Ruben and Sean has worked on. So wanted to thank them for that.
Yeah, we're going to have to start a trophy wall. Okay, do we have a motion on this resolution?
I move that we adopt 2211-21, adopting the district's investment policy.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2211-21, adopting the district's investment policy. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, our next item is resolution. Has somebody with an open mic. Our next item is resolution 2212-21, establishing titles and monthly salary ranges for staff employees. Shauna, you got that one as well.
Yeah, I do. I'll do my best here on this one. So there's four positions that we are adding to the staff salary range. Three of them are from the accounting department, called it Accounting Specialist 1, Accounting Specialist 2, and Payroll Coordinator. And so what we did is we signed an LOU with our union to have these three positions removed from the CBA and brought to staff. And this was done primarily to streamline processes in accounting, where we can gain some efficiencies through cross-training that just wasn't practical or feasible in the CBA environment. So by having these positions removed, we'll be better poised for cross-training, coverage on shortfalls with PTO and illnesses, as well as gain some maximum internal efficiencies. The fourth position is called a business systems analyst. And really, this has come from the adoption of our enterprise software system, NISC. We're moving forward and dedicating additional resources towards really optimizing and maintaining the software system as it was designed. We've talked to other utilities, and they've proceeded forward in a similar fashion, creating positions to not only serve utility personnel in a support role, but also ensure that the system is optimized. And so this position will also report to a senior management task force that's going to help the person prioritize strategic initiatives, as well as strategic projects to ensure that we're meeting the elements of our strategic plan. One thing to note, this change in all these positions is not increasing staffing. This particular one is just a consolidation of functions from a position called systems administrator. So we'll have one less systems administrator and then replace it with this new position. So those are the only changes here. So staff recommends approving resolution 2212-21, establishing titles and monthly salary ranges, and then rescinding resolution 2188-21.
Any budget impacts when this, if we pass this right away?
No, there's no budget impacts. In fact, to my knowledge, I would need to double check with JMS, but I believe all the incumbents are maintaining the current salary.
That's correct, Sean.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, do we have a motion on this resolution?
I move that we accept resolution 2212-21, establishing the titles and monthly salary ranges for staff employees.
I second that.
Been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2212-21. Establishing titles and monthly salary ranges for staff employees and rescinding resolution 2188-21. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, our next item is evaluation of operating reserve line of credit. Sean and John, you have those, or that one.
Yeah, give me just a second. I'm going to start a presentation. Can you all see my screen here?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So a few commission meetings ago, staff was tasked at the request of Commissioner Pascal to prepare a presentation outlining the viability of using a line of credit to replace cash regarding our reserve levels. So John and I are going to be going through the presentation together. I have it broken into two segments. The first one is from me, which is an overview of operating reserves. And then John has the risk analysis on the line of credit piece. For my part, I really compiled recommendations from outside resources who I would consider subject matter experts in utility finances, specifically APPA, Moody's, FCS Group, and Piper Sandler. And for those who don't know, APPA is a national public power organization. Moody's is a rating agency who determines credit worthiness for utilities. FCS Group, they conduct hundreds of cost of service analysis for utilities throughout the Northwest. And then finally, Piper Sandler, they're an underwriter who handles financing for utilities nationwide. So I've kind of compiled information from all of those sources, and I'll just be going through that here in this presentation. So the purpose of reserves, I know this might seem somewhat elementary, but really the funds exist to pay expenses. You have to fund your system improvements. Your normal capital expenditures every year should really match the depreciation of your system. And if you're not reinvesting in your system, it's going to eventually catch up with you and require substantial influx of cash all at once to fix deferred maintenance that you've been avoiding. And so when that happens, it could result in rate shock and double-digit increases for customers. So the best approach, and one that we've adopted, is to keep inflationary rate increases. Sorry, it looks like someone's trying to get in. Did we lose Jim?
Looks like it.
I think I just let him back in.
Yeah, he's muted.
There he is.
Okay. Sorry, Jim, we lost you there for a second.
Yeah, my regular PC is cutting on and off, so I'm going to have to go back to the iPad.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay.
I'm just going to stick with the iPad.
Okay. So anyways, another purpose of reserves is to pay your debt service. Anytime that we borrow money, we have to ensure that we can pay it back. Also, unanticipated cost contingencies, you know, what happens if we get sued or we have to hire contractors, major storms that take out our line, substation, we have to have money set aside in reserves to handle, you know, things that we just can't predict. Reserves will also help us phase in large rate adjustments, which is exactly why we have a rate stabilization account. In case we ever need it, it's going to help smooth things over for our customers over time. And then finally, reserves ensure healthy fiscal policies and success for the utility and management. So along with reserves, we have a financial policy in place which helps guide staff and the board by giving us a roadmap to what we consider success. Our policy helps provide detailed description of the methodologies used in calculating and amassing our reserves. It also ensures that we maintain adequate reserve levels with major changes in management or the board. It also requires us to periodically review cash levels and determine future needs for borrowing. You know, for example, as we look out 1, 5, 10 years into the future, do we need to rate finance our capital or do we need to go out for bonds? Our policy also reduces the risk and chance of any unexpected rate shock. If we're following our policy, we should really see, you know, things coming down the road. They're also very important to rating agencies. And they really determine our cost of borrowing. So if we have low reserves, we could get an unfavorable rating with Moody's, which will significantly increase our interest expense. It also gives confidence to staff and the board that we're doing things right. Auditors really love to see our policies and audit to those. And it also allows us, by having a policy, to really benchmark ourselves against our peers and industry standards. So as I said, I took you know, information from multiple facets, and the first one here is from APPA. And they have a recommended framework for your reserve policy, and it really touches on three key attributes. And first, what they recommend is that our policy should identify a floor for what you allow your reserves to fall to before a particular action is taken. So if it, for example, if your policy says if we get to 100 days, we're going to have a rate increase until we get it back over that. Second, you should allow cash to flow above your minimum targets because the year's expenditures are very cyclical. It allows for fluctuations in, you know, winter versus summer peaking utilities. And for us, we typically see reserves drop throughout the summer due to low revenue months. And so our expenses often exceed revenue for several months out of the year. So what may have looked like an abundance of cash in May will actually dwindle towards the end of the year. And finally, they recommend that reserves fluctuate based on your capital and system reinvestment. So maybe you know in 18 months that you have to spend $3 million on a substation rebuild. So up until that money is spent, it might look like you have excess reserves, but in reality, that money is already earmarked for that project. And so because of this, many utilities will actually subtract out non-deferred capital expenses from the day's cash on hand calculations. They also have what they call influencing factors that they suggest you incorporate into your policy. And it has to do with timing differences between when expenses are incurred and when you actually receive revenue from the customers. So on a cash basis, there could be a 45 to 90 day lag from when the customer actually consumes the power until we bill and receive the payment. They also say that future capital improvement plan may require you to build reserves and prepare for that expenditure. And the case in point is our CETA decarbonization fund. We're setting monies aside to comply with CETA and potentially build a battery project at one of our substations in the near future. You also need to pay your annual debt service and include that payment in your reserves. You should also plan for historical asset investments. We need to plan cash flow appropriately to ensure that we're investing in our system. And quite frankly, our customers expect and demand reliability, and it's our job to ensure that we're planning strategically for this. And finally, you know, we need to plan for storms. We have had storms in the past in our service territory that in a few days will cost us over $1 million. And it's a substantial hit to your reserves when FEMA assistance typically takes a year or longer. So APPA, they have a five-factor approach in determining your reserves. It's a mathematical formula, which is a deviation from the traditional days cash on hand number that you hear quite a bit. And they've broken this down into five different categories. So the first one here is O&M, and what they're saying is you should allocate anywhere from 12 to 25% of your O&M expenses by converting those expenses to working capital days. So I use the minimum level just to have the lowest reserve number, which is 45 days. And it's probably somewhat aggressive considering COVID has caused delays in payments, but you know, we can always alter the number if we need to. For power costs, they suggest taking your highest month of the year and converting it to working capital days. I believe for us that was February of last year. And then historical investment in assets, what they want you to do is take a percentage of your net plant, and based on how much of your system is depreciated, you allocate a percentage of the total. So for us, we're about 40% depreciated, and anything under 50%, they suggest using 1% to allocate. So that's what I did. And in your annual debt payment, you need to account for a full year. And then on the capital, you need to take a five-year capital plan and then account for 1/5 or 20%. So when I do all of that for our utility specifically, I know this is kind of hard to see, but you can see it comes out to the highlighted number there, just over $22 million. And when you convert that to a day's cash on hand, it's roughly 147 days. And just to refresh, our current policy in place has our minimum target at 120 days with an upper threshold of 180. So that APPA target is just kind of right in the middle of those two numbers. And for reference, at the end of June, which is when I made this presentation, we were at 128 days. cash on hand. And then we also had our rate stabilization account, which is, per our policy, supposed to be 6% of the current year's rate revenue. So approximate balance in there right now is $3.9 million. Okay. So Moody's, I grabbed some information from Moody's. This is, again, our rating agency. And this particular slide here was taken from a presentation that they made on utility financing specifically. And it outlined their suggested targets to make sure that your utility will receive a high rating. And for a AAA rating, you can see here they show that you need more than 250 days. And then for a AA rating, which is what we achieved in 2018 at our last bond issuance, they recommend between 150 and 250 days cash on hand. And so in our policy, we actually reference maintaining our current rating with Moody's of AA3. And staff desires to definitely maintain this current rating because it's helped us achieve favorable financing in the past.
Sean,
yeah, go ahead.
Let me add to that that we're told, too, that that AA rating that we have is the highest rating that we can have for UT our size. So we want to maintain that high rating.
Correct, yep.
And, Sean, on this slide here it says a AA rating requires having between 150 and 250. I thought the previous slide showed that we were less than 150.
We were, but the last time that we were rated by Moody's was back in 2018. And just to add clarity here, this isn't the only factor that they look at when they're doing your rating. It's one of the factors, but this is their recommendation. And it wasn't this high in 2018 when we went for bonds. They've actually upped this since we went out for bonds in 2018.
So do you expect that the next time that we're rated by Moody's that we'll have to increase the number of days?
Moody's, we actually, for the 2021 issuance, we have a call with Moody's, I believe it's at the beginning of October. And I'm hopeful, Rick, to answer your question, that we will meet this 150 threshold. And the reason for that is because typically they will count your rate stabilization fund into your total reserves, which would take it to the 150.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So on benchmarking, I went to WAPUTA. They're really a wealth of information when it comes to comparing yourself to other Washington PUDs. And so on this slide here, I was only able to get 18 of the PUDs. And you'll see in the right-hand column here, this is as of 12/31/20, but I do have a few more that I've updated since that I was able to get. So you can see it's really a huge range between all the PUDs in the state. You know, at the top here, you have PUDs like Grant and Clark, where they have generation. So, you know, what they require is going to be significantly different than what we require. Ponderay, you know, they have 300 days, but they're also planning to lose their largest customer, which is an industrial customer, and I believe it's close to a third of their total load. So they've been amassing reserves for a couple of years because they know that's coming. And when they have to raise rates, they're going to try to supplant some of the increases through reserves. So right now we're in the bottom third, I guess you would say, but we're following our policy, and I feel really comfortable with where we're at right now.
Sean, do you think that this is an apples-to-apples comparison? In other words, if we were to look at, say, Ferry, they're not using a rate stabilization to get to that 176?
There's no way for me to know if all of these are a apples-to-apples comparison. I know, for example, like on Mason 1, we talked to them about why theirs was so low. And one thing that they do is they take out their deferred capital. So whatever they're planning on spending for capital in the year, they actually take that out of their day's cash on hand. So if they add that back in, it's going to be, you know, higher. So
wouldn't this also be a function of this utility size? Mason 1 is pretty small. I think they've got about 5,000 customers, and they're O&M costs would be a lot less.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why people report the way that they do. But to answer your question, Rick, I don't know if it's an apples-to-apples comparison on every single one of these.
Thank you.
Yeah. When Waputo sent out the survey, they just basically asked, can you give us what your reserve levels are as of this date? And this is the reporting that came back. Finally, what really sparked this presentation was from a customer inquiry. And talking to the customer, they were comparing us to a co-op. And so as we started to go into our analysis, the customer suggested that, you know, maybe we should lower our reserve levels and purchase a line of credit to supplant the number of days of cash that we have on hand. And so we did some research, and rating agencies will allow you to use credit limits in calculating reserves, which is quite commonplace in the co-op model. However, when we dove into this, there's some stark differences between what the PUD and co-op models have, and so it's worth noting. First, the co-ops have access to different borrowing sources than what the PUD does, specifically rural utility services and the National Rural Utilities Cooperative Finance Corporation. And our understanding is that these organizations really cater to the co-op and the small utility model and therefore have less restrictions on obtaining financing. They also offer really low interest rates to co-ops to make borrowing frequently more favorable and less expensive than what it would typically cost a PUD to issue bonds for. And so many times these utilities are so small that they'll just go to RUS and CFC, who act as a one-stop shop where they handle the cost of service, the rate setting functions, the funding needs, et cetera, for these co-ops. And for PUDs, these are typically individualized services that you would contract out for at a substantial cost. And then finally, RUS and CFC are more lenient with the requirements as far as debt-to-asset ratios and debt service coverage ratios are concerned. And what we've been told is that co-ops can be heavily leveraged without really affecting favorable interest rates. And for a PUD, that's not something that we can actually do. And then lastly, the co-op model focuses on what's called a return on investment to its members. And so what they do is they hand out what they call capital credits or patronage dividends or patronage refunds. And what these are is an allocation of the operating margins as equity to their customers. And so because of this, co-ops can actually operate on a no-cost basis in a tax-free environment, which, again, is something, unfortunately, that PUDs can't do. And so these dividend payments are issued by their board of directors, and most payouts have a 15 to 20-year rotation, meaning that any margins that are generated today will be paid out at a certain percentage 15 to 20 years into the future. So there are some differences between the operations of the two entities, and thereby reserve levels and requirements are just going to be inherently different. And reducing reserves, in my opinion, could substantially increase our customers' risk. It would potentially increase rate shock to our customers if we decided to draw down our reserves. But even with the differences, we wanted to look at the two models, and we also wanted to do a deep dive into the cost and risk analysis associated with obtaining a line of credit specifically. And with that, I'll turn it over to John for the next piece to actually talk about that analysis and what a line of credit might look like for our utility.
Just might I add that we have actually used the reserves to smooth out and reduce rate shock, especially back in 2021. I'm sorry. God, I've got my years wrong. 2001.
All right. So, John, I think you should be able to share your screen. And if you're talking, you're on mute.
Yeah, I shared my screen and I lost my capability, so I'll try that again. Yeah. Okay, does everybody see the presentation, line of credit risk analysis?
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Unfortunately, we're going to go a little bit into the weeds here because you have to do that to do a robust analysis. And I'm going to go over some of our assumptions. Now, keep in mind the latest bond issue where we're getting interest rates at 2% are fairly atypical. So when we do our analysis, we're looking at what historically, let's say over the last 8 to 10 years, has been our financial situation. So the current conditions for a base analysis includes an incremental cost of borrowing of 3.5%. And that is what we are assigning the return on investment, or what we consider the value to the customer for basically a line of credit or having the money in hand. We also are utilizing a rate revenue requirement a little bit more than the 2.25% that we project over the next couple of years at 2.5%. And we selected somewhat arbitrarily a $4.5 billion line of credit for the analysis, and that equates to approximately 30 days cash on hand. We also are assuming a line of credit rate of 4.5%, which is prime plus 1.25% of the balance of the line of credit based on, I believe it was First Federal. We had a couple phone calls and kind of delved into what this might look like if we were to pursue a line of credit. As part of that conversation, we got a pretty comfortable feeling that the annual line of credit expense, regardless of the amount borrowed, would be on the order of 0.6% of the line of credit maximum. And then looking out over the last 8 or 10 years, we're assuming interest on liquid cash accounts at about 1%. Today, it's much less than that. What we believe over the course of, let's say, a five-year interval, will probably come out of these historical lows to something like what we've seen for the last, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We're also doing an analysis of what happens if everyone's projection of interest rates going up. And we did a second analysis that looked at a higher interest rate environment, nothing like double digits, but let's say our bond rate is 5% or that equivalent to the return on investment. And our rate requirement is 4%. The line of credit amount stays the same, but we expect a substantial increase in the prime rate to over 6%, leaving us a line of credit rate of 7.5%. We also expect the expense or the cost of maintaining that to increase proportionally to 0.86%. And we also, in that environment, would expect to get more return on cash reserve, but not as much as the increase on return on investment, because that is would be atypical of our experience. So this table gives a kind of like an overview of what the analysis is looking at, assuming no use of the line of credit. Of course, there's a net present value of $4.5 million to the customer. That's money we did not collect from the customer to maintain a cash reserve. And if you look at the columns on the right, based on return on investment, that gives you an annual cost to the customers of that $4.5 million represents. Okay, the base line of credit expense, it's fairly economical to assume a line of credit, about three quarters of $1 million. And on a annual basis, that's in current environment only $27,000 a year to maintain, $38,000 in an increased interest environment. Now, for return on cash reserve, we do have liquid assets of, let's say, $4.5 million. We would normally expect a return, and that comes to a net present value of about $1.3 million. So basically, we're looking at two cases, one with a return on cash and one without a return on cash. With a return on cash, where we would get an interest on our liquid assets, we're looking at a net present value of a line of credit being north of $2.4 million. And if we exclude the return on cash, $4.5 million line of credit is a net present value of almost $3.7 million. And if you look at the annual basis with a 3.5% and 5% return on investment, you're looking at the first case, $85,000 a year. Second case, over $96,000 a year. The last rows of this table is basically just stating the assumptions so that anyone looking at the analysis will know exactly where we're getting our numbers from. Okay, base analysis. Okay, this debates on whether you include return on liquid assets or not. And we feel pretty comfortable with our assumptions that a line of credit that supplants existing operating reserve or base cash on hand should consider the loss of return on cash that is currently actual. Now, if you're increasing base cash on hand through a line of credit, you should do one or two things, either exclude a return on cash that is only a future potential, or consider the negative net present value of the rate impact necessary to achieve an additional future cash reserve. This is an important distinction. So basically, it sets up two scenarios. One, supplanting cash with a line of credit. The other, increasing cash from your current position. Okay, so reducing actual cash reserve or utilizing an existing line of credit for an emergency requires mitigation. As Sean mentioned, that's a near-term rate increase or a series of rate increases. And for an interval to pay down a line of credit or restore your cash reserve or liquid assets. And then that would be followed by a rate decrease after payoff to return to prior base rate revenue requirements. And during this time, if you do have a line of credit, you have to have temporary mitigation of an unfavorable debt position if you're actually using a line of credit because you have worsened your cash to debt ratio beyond what you would have done if you had a liquid cash reserve. And one of those mitigations might be an increase in your line of credit to cover the transit. Okay, risk is another thing that is very subjective, but for our purposes, we're describing that as X percent annual risk of borrowing the full line of credit is roughly equivalent to 2x the risk of borrowing half, or 3x percent the borrowing of one-third of the line of credit. We're doing a very simple basic analysis. What is the risk of using a line of credit, and what does it cost? Okay, so if we use the full line of credit, these are four scenarios identified in the rows of the table. In the first column is the additional rate impact to mitigate the transient of using a line of credit. And I've selected 1/2, 1, 2, and 4% increases above the base rate, which would be today roughly 3, 3.5, 4.5, or 6.5 rate increases. And then for a period of time, as I call a recovery in years, until the $4.5 million is restored, it can be as much as 12 years for a nominal rate increase of 0.5%, almost 7 years for a 1% rate increase, 3.5 years for a 2% rate increase, and a 4% rate increase that would be restored within 2 years. And then, of course, you have a post-recovery rate deduction. And then during the time of the transit, you'll incur an interest expense that if you prolong the payback, can, of course, exceed $1 million. And if you're prompt in your payback, you'll owe that expense to as little as $180,000 if you're willing to increase rates as much as 4%. Now, there's an additional cash support expense, approximately 20%, in addition to the interest expense, to ensure you maintain your debt ratios as well as your additional cash on hand for an amplification or additional line of credit. So in essence, a line of credit functions as a relatively low interest emergency credit card. Paying off the debt faster reduces interest costs, but has a higher transitory rate impact. If used, the line of credit results in unfavorable cash debt ratio than an all cash reserve, resulting in the cash support expense for equivalency, which we have selected about 20% to the best of our information available is what it would cost us. Okay, so the analysis include a rate tolerance between 0.5% and 4% above a 2.5 base revenue requirement. That's 3 to 6.5% actual rate increases. We've evaluated line of credit use for up to 20% and 30% risk. And we also did a model for a scenario with a rise in prime interest rates of 3.5%. And of course, we have to consider whether we're supplanting existing days cash on hand, where we would include return on liquid assets, and other cases where we're growing days cash on hand through a line of credit, and that would not consider days cash on hands or wouldn't consider liquid asset return. So, excuse me, the line of credit cost use versus percent rate increase tolerance. Now, I try to illustrate basically what the cost is if we had to utilize the line of credit due to some emergency in the amount of $4.5 million. And as you see, if we're slow in restoring cash, we incur a significantly higher cost for using a line of credit. And of course, if we pay it off sooner and have a high tolerance for interest, the cost per use is rather minimum. Now, of course, as interest rates increase, the cost per use, of course, does increase as well. So as you see on this chart, for a single use at, let's say, 2% rate increase, then we could expect the cost of using this line of credit is something a little north of about $410,000. Of course, if we are slow paying it back, 0.5%, we're up to $1.2 million. Most of that is interest expense, but also maintaining our cash equivalency. So you multiply this function by the risk, that gives you your annual cost of utilizing the line of credit over and beyond the base cost. So this is a rather colorful chart, but it tries to illustrate what's going on with respect to rate tolerance and use of the line of credit. And this is the assumption that we're supplanting existing cash, which means we consider the return on liquid assets. So we start with a net present value here of about $2.4 million on the $4.5 million line of credit. And of course, depending on your rate tolerance, we'll select 2%, saying that if our customers are very tolerant of a 2% rate impact, then we can follow this line to where it crosses the zero net present value line, and that equates to a 16.2% risk of use per year is roughly a wash, meaning it's zero net present value. If we're willing to pay it off sooner, it goes way out beyond the chart and is very favorable. If we're very hesitant to increase rates, let's say we tolerate only a 0.5% rate, that has a risk equivalent of something less than 6%. So, of course, this is very subjective. It's depending on the actions of future boards and management on how this is handled and utilized. Now, keep in mind, this dashed line would add roughly 1.3 to the net present value if you're actually growing the day's cash on hand, illustrated here. So the situation before, where we were looking at 16% as being the break-even point on risk, is more like 25% if you're growing your cash reserve beyond the additional existing level. So basically, this makes the case that it's much more advantageous to utilize a line of credit for growing your reserve as opposed to supplanting cash or for using as an emergency. It's very advantageous. And I believe some utilities have actually gotten into line of credits due to an actual emergency, which they wanted to avoid a significant rate impact. So once again, the net present value is almost $3.7 million and falls off at the same slope as the previous. You just cross the axis or the break-even axis at a later point. Okay, this scenario is in a more adverse interest rate environment, and with additional interest rates, you incur more interest expense when you use it. And for illustrative purposes, comparing the first chart here to the high interest rate chart here, you'll see that the 2% rate tolerance line falls from 16% risk to 10% or 10.5% risk. Meaning in this environment, if you have the need to use a line of credit one out of 10 years, you're at your break-even point. Once again, if you're very low tolerance on rate increases and you're looking at 1% rate increases, that risk is more like 6% or 6/10 of a percent out of 10 years. So the higher the interest rate, the less likely a line of credit is going to be favorable for our utility. So in conclusion, we know at least two Washington PUDs utilize the line of credit for part of the day's cash on hand, and several more are considering the option. We know this in part by the latest WPUDA meeting that we actually discussed this. I believe it may have been Commissioner Roundtable. We also know the a line of credit can be a powerful tool for restoring an operating reserve deficit due to unforeseen emergency that has occurred. We know one of our local PUDs nearby actually utilized the line of credit due to a multi-million dollar impact on the system. And under many assumptions, a line of credit is the lowest cost option to increase cash reserves. It's a fairly good value to increase reserve. But using a line of credit to supplant existing day's cash on hand is not really consistent with the provide stable rate strategic plan objectives. Number one, you're looking at least really 2% or more increases as you to ensure the risk is low enough to have high confidence that it works. We do have somewhat arbitrary on our risk assumptions, and we have a lot of uncertainty there. Speculative rate increase tolerance, we don't know what a future board will do. And unclear net present value, this is the best information available. So it's not a dramatic improvement one way or the other over liquid cash. And the risk increases if interest rates rise from historic lows. Now, probably the most important factor for us, though, that plays into this from an equity standpoint, the district's unencumbered day's cash on hand has been fairly consistent for the last 15 years. So if we were to make initiative to reduce our day's cash on hand and replace it with a line of credit, it would be somewhat arbitrarily refunding the funds to ratepayers today without consideration of what has been done in the past. So our recommendation is for line of credit options should be referenced in the next revision of the financial reserve policy. Develop parameters, condition, and purpose of a line of credit option. include the line of credit option prior to significantly exceeding historical days cash on hand for both customer equity and risk evaluated value to the customers, and initially consider a line of credit with up to 30 days equivalent days cash on hand. And if we do this, if let's say we're about 150 days today, and we desire to be at 180 days, and if we did that through a line of credit as opposed to rates, it will have a slightly lower forecast rate increase for 2024 and beyond, because currently we project that days cash on hand starting then or 2025 will probably increase beyond the 15-year historic average. Okay, a lot of information there. Let me know if you have questions. We try to be objective in our analysis, and we have to use some assumptions, but we have a pretty good comfort level in how we could utilize a line of credit in the future.
John, is the line of credit renewed annually, and is it a fixed rate for that period, or is it variable? Or?
Yes, it would be renewed annually, and it would be somewhat sensitive to interest rates, but we have pretty high confidence talking to the holder of most of our cash accounts that we could today and probably next year get a quote of roughly 0.6% in the line of credit.
But to answer your question, Will, it would be prime plus a certain percentage.
No, I think Will was talking about the expense of maintaining.
Oh, the expense of maintaining. Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions?
I think we lost Jim again.
Thank you.
He's back.
Yep.
Good presentation, John.
All right. Well, that's it. That completes our presentation on line of credit, and we will be looking at an update at some point in the future on the financial reserve policy, probably next year. And we'll introduce some language on how we might utilize the line of credit as an emergency function or for growing cash reserves beyond, let's say, 150 days cash on hand.
And is that where you're coming? Is that where you think your recommendation is going to come in, John?
Ultimately, it's, right now, there's a question. I believe Ricky had a question about the different utilities, and if we're talking apples to apples. And right now, they're all over the map. We saw that in the WPUTA meeting. Some exclude capital. Some include, some exclude some of the other accounts from cash. So right now, we know that a line of credit may be useful for growing days cash on hand beyond historic numbers. And if the rating agencies continue to push for higher and higher days cash on hand, we will probably recommend that we consider and utilize the days line of credit to increase the days cash on hand, as our other PUDs currently consider.
Thank you, John.
So here, I hate to even say this, but if you had a major event like Cascadia default, and your line of credit didn't cover that, can you go back to the well, or what's that scenario look like?
Well, we're participating in Cascadia Rising, and I hesitate to say what the expectations are.
Okay, good. Thank you. Enough said. Thank you, John. That was a great presentation, and Sean, you as well. Any other discussion on that?
None for me.
Okay, let's move on to the Bonneville Power Administration's post-2028 contract discussion.
Don't believe we had any meetings since the last staff or board meeting, have we?
No, I don't think so. I think, when is the next one?
Tomorrow.
Next, is it tomorrow or next Tuesday? Okay, good.
Yes, tomorrow.
And that's to talk about carbon, right?
I think so, yes, sir.
Okay, well, then we'll move on to correspondence and communication. Doug, do we have any?
I got myself unmuted here, Will. Yeah, just let me give a couple of things. I was going to, I think Rick had asked a little update on how it has impacted the PUD. I think we had during the time from, say, March till July, so about 18-month period, we had only two employees that were impacted by COVID. But since August, the number has grown to about 13. And of those 13, I believe five of them actually had been vaccinated. So we're watching. Thus far, employees are coming out of it. Okay, there's still a bunch that are in it, either with themselves or their families involved or having exposed to it. So this Delta variant is a lot more contagious than we've seen previously, and we're watching over it. We're putting out a message to our employees to be diligent and to, you know, make sure they're doing the social distancing, wearing the masks, and sanitizing, washing hands. So we're staying on top of it. So that was the first message. The second message, Will, I thought I'd mention that immediate release. We had something out here that announced that on August 31st, Energy Northwest Executive Board elected a board chairman for Will Purser. So Will Purser is now the board chairman of the Executive Board for Energy Northwest. And Will was on that on the Board of Commissioners with since 2001, and on the Executive Board since 2010. So I think what's often overlooked is the impact that Energy Northwest actually has to the Qualum PUD. Being a clean energy source, it helps that way. All of the utilities in the Northwest, and in particular, Energy Northwest has maybe Will, you can give more about it, but they have the wind. You know, they have the core nuclear plant. They have a lot of other things that helps us keep our rates lower. In a number of past years, because of BPA, or with BPA, Energy Northwest West has actually lowered BPA rates in a few cases when they refinanced and did some other things. So, Will, I don't know if you want to add to that, but that's all I have for communication. Maybe you can tell a little bit more about Energy Northwest.
Doug, I had a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
With respect to the vaccination and the employees, do you have an idea about what percent of our employees have been vaccinated?
You know, I don't, Rick. Jamie's been following that and keeps good track of that. I don't know, Sean, do you have that information at all? I think we're trying to get more on a personal basis. We're definitely not talking names, but
yeah, the ones that have notified HR were about 26%.
And we believe there might be some others out there that haven't.
Yeah, those are the ones that have notified us.
Well, yeah. The reason I brought it up was I was wondering if we have a low percentage of employees that have gotten vaccinated, whether we should consider some type of incentive to encourage employees to get vaccinated, or just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I know we haven't considered that, Rick.
Okay, back to Energy Northwest. You know, Energy Northwest is a joint operating agency of public utilities. There's 26 to 28 participants in Energy Northwest. They are on an asset basis. They are, of course, the core is still the Columbia Generating Station, but we're migrating beyond that. Nuclear power is zero carbon and isn't considered zero carbon, so it'll be important going forward into the CETA period. Energy Northwest also has developed over the years and recently a number of solar farms. More recently, there's one called the I can't come up with the name. Angel Falls, Ruby Falls, that's what it is. Ruby Falls solar farm, which would be a 100 megawatt facility, and they're working with a developer to get subscriptions to that. They also operate a number of dams, either through contract or directly. And of course, they have Nine Canyon Wind Farm, and there's a major wind farm being considered for Eastern Washington once again, which would be on the scale of Nine Canyon. So they are going to be a important provider going forward to meet CETA. And of course, we've already talked about small modular reactor activity. They have a memo of understanding with Grant to build and operate a small modular reactor. Right now, that's X Energy, is technology. And if that goes forward, then Energy Northwest will be providing technical assistance. They'll be providing perhaps operating and maintenance services to that facility, as well as siting and licensing assistance through our connections with the NRC. There's also the NuScale project, which is over in Idaho, and Energy Northwest has a understanding with NuScale to operate that facility if it gets off the ground. They also operate with TerraPower, which is Bill Gates' nuclear approach, and they're offering technical assistance to TerraPower and siting assistance as well. So it's and having said that, Energy Northwest major customer for CGS Power is Bonneville. In fact, it is the only customer. So it impacts Bonneville's cost of power. It impacts Bonneville's budget. And so anyway, it's a pretty important piece of public power right now. The Doug mentioned the regional cooperation debt. That's where Bonneville can go to the Treasury and get money at something like 7%. Energy Northwest can go to the market and get it at 2.5% to 3%. So Energy Northwest has been issuing bonds to Bonneville's benefit, and that has resulted in, last time I looked, was something like $2 billion in benefit to rate customers and reduce cost. So we'll see how it goes going forward. There's a lot of irons in the fire right now. And in fact, at the last meeting, I formed a task force to look at excellence in governance, to look at the committees of the executive board, and they're going to come forward with some recommendations for changes. We'll see if those are adopted, and more later. And by the way, being the chair doesn't pay anymore. So. That's Okay, commissioner reports. Jim, you want to lead us off?
Yeah, okay. Let's see, last meeting, referred. Okay, I think I got this right. On the 24th of August, I attended the in-person North Olympic Development Council. They had an all-day workshop where they talked about the development of the preparation of a five-year development plan, an economic development plan for the North Olympic Peninsula. And so we broke up into different groups and so forth and discussed that different aspects of the economic picture in the county. They gave a presentation that had some pretty interesting demographic data that sort of surprised me. A couple things is that there's a huge, and this should be no surprise to anybody that's lived around here a few years, is that the young people can't afford to leave the area, you know, by the time they're 25 or 30, essentially because they can't afford to live here. And so our kids that are growing up here and going to school and so forth are moving away. And, of course, other kids are moving in and trying to make a living here. They, too, are having a hard time with the cost of living. And
did we lose Jim?
Yeah, we lost him again, Will.
Okay, I'm back. I got a thing that cuts out for a few seconds here. You guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, you're back on.
Okay. What was also interesting, though, was given the total population of the county versus the employment statistics, I can't remember the exact numbers, but what was really interesting is that when you take out retirees and then what's left, you know, people earning a salary, it's mostly government people by a lot. And we're talking local, state, and federal. And that's the overwhelming base of our economy is, retirees' paychecks and government salaries. So I think that's something that, from a strategic standpoint, we need to be mindful of. The other thing, on the 25th was the Northwest Power Pool RA program. They gave some analysis and so forth. BPA was a presenter. BPA said energy, not capacity. To meet or energy is what to meet the 1 or 2 hour demand is what is driving them. But anyway, it was I don't know, I didn't find that presentation all that impressive, but nevertheless it was pretty good. WAPAC also had a meeting later in August, and they went through the Cube Bonneville Powers quarterly business review, cash on hand, stuff like that. Bonneville looks pretty good right now, cash on hand, but they've had some things that we have to keep in mind. One is they're still showing the $100-something million rollover from last year because of the boom they made in late summer last year with the energy, the heat in California. They also have had some delayed capital expenses, so that drives up their cash on hand picture temporarily. So, it looks great, but it's not quite as good as it should be. But they're certainly not in trouble by any means. I'm missing something here. So the other thing that WAPAG talked about was they also talked about the RA program at BPA, and what they did is they showed a chart, and I think this was also in the Northwest Power Pool presentation the day before. And you guys have seen this before. It's this chart that's been around since early 2019 that showed demand you know, with the E3 study, White Book, several others and so forth. And I pointed out that given that chart is that old, well, it's not that old, but a couple of years, but still, that chart is showing that right now there should be a 2,500 megawatt shortage of power. And of course, that's simply not the case. And so I pointed out that maybe somebody could update with actual numbers what those numbers really are. And Brian Neal at WAPAG reminded me that in earlier this year in their EIM comments to BPA, that chart was used, or that in a presentation they pointed out that that chart is at significant odds with the power planning councils, and that if, you know, we've got such a discrepancy here that, and, you know, we're hinging big decisions in terms of investment strategies or, you know, for utilities and what we do with rate case and so forth, that perhaps somebody needs to resolve the difference between those two things. That's about all I have. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim. Rick?
I went to two meetings on the 24th of August. Bonneville had another one of their education meetings, if you will, and I didn't have any notes from that meeting. On the 26th of August, I attended a Waputa meeting, and they had a good presentation on battery storage, and I noted in my notebook that the results that they had vindicate some of the analysis that John has been doing. So I thought that that was noteworthy, and wanted to give John a pat on the shoulders for getting that vindication. But that's all I've got, Will.
Rick, was that meeting you went to Waputa or WAPAG?
Waputa. Yeah, Waputa. Did I say WAPAG?
No, you said Waputa, but I was at the WAPAG meeting on the 26th. That's, I heard that same thing, so I thought maybe
maybe I wrote the wrong title down. Could very well happen.
Okay.
It's the alphabet soup.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've already talked about my activities at Energy Northwest. We did have a annual retreat of the executive board, and this is the first time that Bob Schutz, our new CEO, has sat in that chair. And if I talked about Bob before our selection of CEO, I'm sorry, what?
In passing, yes, you've mentioned it.
Yeah, well, Bob was the successful candidate for the new CEO there, replacing Brad Swarsky. Bob was deputy commander of the Pacific Nuclear Submarine Fleet. He's been at INPO. He's been at Energy Northwest for something like 10 years now. And he's shaping up. I think he'll do a great job for us. So, in fact, I'm supposed to sit down with him at the end of this week and talk through. We have to set expectations and all that kind of stuff, but I think he'll do a great job for us. And that's about all I had. I think we talked about Energy Northwest enough.
Hey, Will?
Yeah.
There was a meeting NWPPA had on the 8th and 9th, and I called and gave Scott Sims, who's the head guy at NWPPA, a hard time because it was an in-person only meeting.
You mean Scott Corwin?
Scott Corwin, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was pretty irresponsible.
I backed out. I was going to go to that, but everybody I talked to was concerned about it. I'd be interested to know what kind of turnout they had because
he said that they had 200 registered. And I said, well, I sure hope that doesn't turn into a super spreading event. But I just told him I didn't feel comfortable being around that many people and that they should have had a virtual option for that meeting. And I was pretty disappointed that they didn't.
Yeah, I wanted to attend that. For one reason, they were going to give Sid Morrison some accolades, outgoing chairman of Energy Northwest Executive Board, but I got cold feet, and I talked to a number of people that did back out of going, so I think you probably made the right decision. We'll see. Let's hope it's not a super spreader.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, Will, one thing I wanted to mention, it's not a meeting, but I wanted to point out that the Northwest Power and Conservation Plan released their draft power plan here a few days ago. And I started scanning it this morning. It's 127 pages, but I think it's a very interesting read. It's got a lot of in-depth. We've got all the supporting materials to back up everything they're saying in there. They've done a pretty serious job here of trying to articulate the data and so forth and conclusions. One thing that goes back to this this chart that I mentioned that was showing these power deficits, their analysis shows that the demand is basically nearly flat, barely a little bit of demand growth over the next 8 or 9 years. And I'm just starting reading it. There's also, in that amount of demand, it's interesting, the solar that they're projecting, they were actually recommending in the plan, is a lot less than what they modeled. But still, at about 2,000 or 3,000 name capacity, and they're only showing 250 megawatts of annual average, so they're using a very low production factor for solar. Those numbers sort of just taking up any increase in demand, including EVs. And so in conservation, when you throw that in, it just basically, paints a different picture. So I think that we need to, some of us need to read that report and talk about it in light of the where we're headed with the 20.0 and just the general situation with all these renewables and the hydro system and stuff.
I find it really surprising that they're showing such a low load growth with transportation starting to penetrate into the electric market. I mean, that to me, with the goals that they have set for electric vehicles and showing no load growth, that just my gut says that doesn't feel right.
Yeah, I think that's a concern throughout public power right now. You're hearing that from a lot of quarters. They seem to be not stating the potential of EV growth, electrification of transportation.
They certainly went through the analysis. Now, you can challenge their analysis, but they spent a lot of time trying to figure out what those numbers might be. And they looked at different avenues of how that that EV market would materialize, not just personal vehicles, but light trucks, heavy trucks, and all that kind of stuff. So I think they've done a probably as credible job as anybody else has. But you also have to keep in mind, demand is also reflecting a decrease in large single load resources. And that's been happening ever since the aluminum plant started closing down 20 years ago. And so you've got several things going on here that are, pushing down load growth and demand in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it'd be interesting what the long term, we're on the leading edge of the electrification of transportation. It's certainly going to grow in the future, but so maybe in future power plans they'll capture that. Okay, our next item is staff reports. We have the Mono Carbon Corporation update on prospective customer and local power generation. John, are you there? There he is.
Well, forgive me. Every time I pull up the presentation, I lose my controls for the meeting. So do you currently see Mono Carbon update?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we do.
Okay, this shouldn't take more than 6-7 minutes, but basically I believe the commissioners are somewhat familiar with this through email communications, but as an overview, Mino Carbon Corporation is evaluating the feasibility of a biochar plant at a property west of the Interfor Mill in the Port Anastas area. The plant would convert unstable organic material, including forestry waste products, into a stable carbon sequestered biochar product. The process includes pyrolysis, in which the organic material is heated in a high temperature to a high temperature in an electric furnace in the absence of oxygen. And biochar has a variety of economic uses, as well as what we believe is a syngas byproduct that can be used for combustion generation. We believe that the actual carbon product is primarily intended to be used as a soil additive to increase soil productivity. So basically, on August 30th, PUD and Mino Carbon Corporation management teams met for an information exchange. We could not meet during the Port Angeles presentation that preceded that by a week or so. But we met with Mino Carbon participants for Calistad, CEO Anthony Pinio, Business Development Director, as well as Ryan Snipe, Corporate Development Director. For the PUD, he had Doug, myself, and Sean. And the Minor Carbon participants subsequently met with those in our engineering department for introductions and some discussions over in engineering. So basically, the topics discussed included electric load requirements on the order of 2.5 megawatts, primarily for the electric furnace. You'll note that's well under the new large single load criteria from BPA, which is a good thing. Site generation capacity of up to 12 megawatts. That's an important number. Site transmission interconnect, we spoke in general. No technical or really engineering specifics, but just in general. We also talked about BPA contract limitations for local offtake until post-2028. And we also talked with them about CETA and the future electric supply outlook for the region. As you're aware, previously staff determined that the proposed generation is CETA compliant and therefore favorably marketable in Washington as a potential base or shapeable supply. So actually, it's being CETA compliant is very important in the run-up to 2030, especially as IOUs have to come under the 20% cap on carbon supply. Also, at this time, staff does not believe the proposed generation will require the PUD to register with NERC because it's under 20 megawatts. But we also, to be certain, contracted with GDS Associates for a second opinion on NERC registration, and we expect that opinion by the end of September. That's really important because if we had to register with NERC, it would mean that the company we had to register would have to fund the cost, which can be very substantial when you're looking at transmission operator, load serving entity, distribution provider, as well as, potentially other classifications. So that's looking good so far. Okay, at the conclusion of a meeting, it was agreed that the next steps are for Mino Carbon to consult internally and designate their engineering and technical project participants. And based on the latest information I have, that is expected to happen by the end of September. And right after that, they will let us know and we'll facilitate a meeting with BPA, PUD, and Mino to discuss and review the respective interconnect requirements. Our guess is October at the earliest. And when we bring BPA on board, that will include transmission, power, as well as engineering. And it will be a fairly complex discussion because we have never done a Tier 3 interconnect for our system. And it's been a long time since BPA has looked at such an interconnect for a generation source in our territory or nearby territories. So unless you have questions, that's the how much we have so far on the discussions associated with Mino Carbon.
John, this technology sounds very similar as to coal gasification, where you partial combustion of coal producing a synthesis gas and then burn that in a gas turbine. Is that the plan here for power generation? Or?
Yeah. The technology is fairly mature even for the biochar, and it's been out there for a couple of decades in moderate scale. What they're looking at is the basically the carbon stream, and the high hurdle there was, is it compliant? So when you have organic materials, wood waste products, when they decompose, they release carbon dioxide as well as methane and other things that are greenhouse gases. And this process basically, for some energy cost, they're reducing the net effect of CO2 production as well as methane production, generating syngas. I believe it's largely hydrogen and carbon monoxide, which then can be used in a turbine. And even though it's a carbon source, when you look at the total stream of carbon, it's a reduction in carbon dioxide equivalents. And what governs is basically how does the state look at it and see with CETA, is it carbon or non-carbon? By all appearances to staff, the state considers it specifically, by exception, non-carbon.
That's because they're reducing forest waste in the woods, producing CO2, but also because it comes under like biomass generation.
Yes, it's essentially the state has recognized this type of biomass project, this type, as being CETA compliant.
Yeah, okay.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. Something can happen at least. Okay. Thank you, John. That was great. It was very informative. I'm sorry, somebody.
I think that was Jim fading out and coming back.
Jim, you need to put more wax on your string.
Okay, fine.
You're there? All right, good.
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, board action board action items. Do we have any tea?
We do not, Will.
Okay, great, thanks. Next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have folks lined up?
Nothing in the chat, but if anybody from the public wants to make a comment, go ahead and let me know now. And hearing none again, Will.
Okay, well, thank you. All right, we're going to recess the regular meeting of the commission and go into an executive session. We'll hold an executive session to review the performance of a public employee and evaluate the qualifications of an applicant for public employment pursuant to RCW 42.30.110(1)(g). So, okay, it's uncertain whether we'll have any action coming out of this meeting. There will be no decisions made in executive session, and we'll have a discussion in open session after the executive session.
And there may or may not be action. Is that right, Will?
That's correct. May or may not be actions. That's right.
And then I'm going to – okay. There you go, Will.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I neglected to say the duration of the executive session. We're going to shoot for 40 minutes, and so that will be the time limit,
yeah.
40 minutes.
If we need more time, we can come back and then ask for more time and go back into executive session.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Okay, I'm going to pause now.
Okay, thank you, Sean.
There's one more. Okay, looks like everybody's in here, Will.
Okay, good. Okay, we discussed the qualifications for internal candidates for CEO during the executive session. We've got some qualified people. No decisions were made. John Purvis has withdrawn his interest in the CEO job due to medical issues. So that leaves us with Sean Worthington. And let me just say here, we briefly talked about external, it was talked about or mentioned that going external and recruiting, based on previous experience, that would cost the utility between $100,000 and $150,000. We are down to 3 months or so before Doug departs, and there's interest in having some overlap with Doug, so recruiting externally would eat up a big chunk of that, so put us in a time crunch. In addition, if you have an external candidate, you're going to be paying moving costs. From recent experience, most external candidates now are expecting housing assistance, which might be the case here in this area. So those are some of those issues that that I'm concerned about. By selecting an internal candidate, we will preserve internal employee morale, have the support of employees. Internal candidate would have established and solid relationships with all employees, including the commissioners, the IBEW, local business, county, municipalities, tribes, and so on. Familiarity with the RCW, the CETA, and existing district progress and programs related to CETA compliance. Familiarity from the candidate and the organizations in WAPUTA, NWPPA, BPA, WAPEG, and current provider of choice contract negotiations, already formed relationships with BPA representatives as well as WAPEG members. There would be a truncated learning curve with an internal candidate due to the knowledge of current district specific electric and water service regulations, policies, finances, management, key personnel, enterprise software systems, etc. As well as an internal candidate would have participated in union negotiations and successfully carried that out. Based on those items, I would put Sean Worthington forward as the as a candidate.
Will, I agree with everything you said. I also recognize the work that the Doug and so forth, and we, you know, during a dedicated transition, I mean, a training program and so forth, developing employees, internal program employees, John and Sean and so forth, that, you know, that effort is, you know, well, is paying off. So I think, and also my experience with Sean has been very professional. He's been very responsive to my questions as a commissioner, and I've seen him in discussions with WAPEG and other groups and so forth, and he's very well qualified, very qualified for this job. I also appreciate the letters of recommendation from some of the folks that we've worked with, he's worked with, associations and other PUDs. So, I agree with you. I think Sean is should be the general manager.
Well, just to add to that, I neglected to say that John will be staying in place, so we'll have a good team. Sean and John Purvis have been understudying Doug for the last year or so and participating in management decisions as a succession-type plan. So that kind of adds to it.
It's Rick, been more like 2 or 3 years.
Oh, has it been that long? Okay.
Yeah, at least 2 years, yeah. More.
As you get older, time flies.
Yeah, well, those great individuals and great leaders here.
Yeah, I think we're very lucky to have internal candidates of this quality. Rick, did you have something?
I think Sean would be a very good candidate, very good general manager.
Okay. Well, does anybody want to make a motion to that effect?
I move that we hire Sean as our new general manager.
And I second that motion.
All right, it's been moved and seconded to hire Sean Worthington as the new general manager of Plalum PUD. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, good. All right, well, thank you very much. I guess we're in good shape. Sean, are you still on?
Yeah, I'm here, Will. I just wanted
you're in
to
shock?
Say, no, I. Well, this whole process has been somewhat of a shock. But I just want to thank all the commissioners for your vote of confidence. I sincerely appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to working with you. I truly value the dedication that each one of you bring to this position, and I look forward to making us one of the best utilities for our employees as well as our customers, and I'm looking forward to it, so thank you.
Well, good. You're going to have some overlap time with Doug, so not that you haven't had some already, but that might be his eternal with the reins. So congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Any other discussion? Or
I'm done.
Okay, good. Doug, did you have anything else?
No, it makes me feel good to know that when I do leave, I feel PUD is going to be in good hands, both with Sean, our leader, with John there helping, and all the other employees for that matter. We've got a bunch of dedicated employees that have shown that over the years, and I do appreciate, as Sean mentioned, the commissioners being interested and getting involved. You've done a great job there too, so I appreciate that, and I'm sure John will too.
Okay, you're not going away right now, so we'll save all the accolades to later, Doug.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, commissioners. You guys did a great job. Appreciate it. As you know, Sean was my recommendation as the position as the general manager.
Okay, good. All right, so with that, I guess we've concluded this meeting, so we stand adjourned.